Okay, Francis, over to you.
Okay. Thanks, guys. Appreciate you working this out, setting up the translations. Terrific. Okay, well, hello, friends. Welcome to this ninth webinar on the Light of the Soul, DK book, which describes our personality condition from an esoteric point of view, and more importantly, provides the means for dismantling our personality orientation in order to become soul infused. Last time we started with the final commentary on the ninth sutra, which states very simply, fancy rests upon images which have no real existence. Fancy is not a word that's used much anymore, but I think as we get into the description, you'll see more and more what it means. It's akin to illusion, glamour, and Maya. So the commentary reads, oops, when the man begins to function as the soul, this image he has created through his quote unquote fancy or his reaction to delusion is dissipated by supreme exertion. It has no real existence once there is nothing in the aspirant to feed it. And the realization of this enables him to free himself from its thraldom. This is back when language, when he and his and him was a gender non-specific word, which is, of course, changed. So the destruction of the dweller cannot occur on the level on which the dweller functions. You cannot fight an astral mental construct using astral mental weapons. We then took up the 10th sutra, which reads, passivity, sleep, is based upon the quiescent state of the vrittis, or upon the non-perception of the senses. The vrittis are the active waveforms of the lower mental substance, citta, including its modifications and fluctuations. These fluctuations bombard the etheric brain, keeping the physical vehicle conscious and outwardly oriented. Sleep is induced when the thread of consciousness is withdrawn from the physical brain, causing the inner observer to stop registering the impacts of the five external senses, while the etheric body remains active in order to bathe the physical vehicle in prana, which is how rest occurs. As a result, the physical brain ceases to record the vrittis that dominate during the waking hours. We then learned that physical perception is a three-part circuit. The sense organs function as passive receptors of environmental vibration. The vrittis act as the active translating waveforms of the lower mind. The I am I principle is the central observer that claims ownership of the translated data. We were then warned about falling into mental passivity during meditation. Quote, this self-imposed quieting is not only a detriment to the achievement of the highest yoga, but is excessively dangerous in many cases. Next, we took a, you know, and if any of these ideas, you would like to explore any of the idea, any of these ideas further, just take a look at the recorded session of Light of the Soul webinar 8, and you can go back over any of these. What I am recapping at this point. Okay. Next, we took a close look at the nature of sleep, including the ordinary sleep of the physical body, sleep of the vrittis, during which the mind ceases to be a reactive mirror of the dense physical world, the sleep of the soul, which covers that part of human experience which dates from a man's first human incarnation until he, quote unquote, awakens to a knowledge of the plan, the sleep of the ordinary medium, wherein the etheric body is partially extruded from the physical body, samadhi, or the sleep of the yogi, and finally, the sleep of the nirmanakayas, a self-imposed condition by a group of beings, also called the divine contemplatives, who form a link between Shambhala and the hierarchy. We then moved on to the 11th sutra of Book One, which states, memory is the holding on to that which has been known, followed by a list of five types of memory, including thought images of that which is tangible, objective, and which has been known by the thinker upon the physical plane, and kama-manasic, or desire, lower mind images of past desires and their gratification. And that pretty much takes us up to where we left off last time. We'll start this session with the last three types of memory. So, could we get a reader, please?
Yes, I'll start us. That memory activity, which is the result of mental training, the accumulation of acquired facts, the consequence of reading or of teaching, and which is not purely based upon desire, but which has its basis in intellectual interest. All the various contacts which the memory holds and recognizes as emanating from the five lower sense perceptions. Those mental images latent in the memory making faculty, which are the total of the knowledge contacted and the realizations evoked by the right use of the mind as a sixth sense. All these forms of the memory faculty have to be dropped and no longer held. They must be recognized as modifications of the mind, of the thinking principle, and therefore as part of that versatile psychic nature which has to be dominated before the yogi can hope to attain liberation from limitation and from all lower activity. This is the goal.
Thank you, BL. So first, the third form of memory, that memory activity, which is the result of mental trainings, right? So thus far we've had tangible thought images, right? Then desire mind images. And now we come to this memory activity, which is the result of mental training, the accumulation of acquired facts, the consequence of reading or of teaching, and which is not purely based upon desire, but which has its basis in intellectual interest. So this is, of course, the lower mind activity, memory resulting from lower mind activity. At this level, the yogi or student's mental body is no longer dominated by the astral body's kamic charge, right? By that charge of desire. As a result, the vritti, that activity of citta, is no longer being powered by the cravings of the solar plexus. Instead of kamic desire, the cohesive force holding these thought forms together is lower manas. This form of chitta is molded into thousands of well-defined informational waveforms, which, unlike the elementals of comic memory, are organized into structured matrices of data, categorization, and logic. Though it's not the end goal, mental training is necessary in order to upgrade the mental body from a reactive kamamanasic sensory processor into an organized instrument of transmission. Four, all the various contexts which the memory holds and recognizes as emanating from the five lower sense perceptions. This is a composite of sensory memories. Keyword here is context, which in occult physics is a meeting of two energies, an external physical vibration like a sound wave, a photon, or a thermal radiation strikes one of the physical sense organs and is immediately transferred to a group of nadis on the etheric web, which translates this contact, this literal physical impression, into an energetic frequency. This etheric current then impacts the substance of the astral vehicle, translating the vibratory frequency into conscious sensation. The lower mind then takes this astral data. Notice that we're moving up from the outer physical. Takes this astral data, the translated impact of the pitch of a bell, the texture of a stone, or the sensation of heat, and records it as a distinct vritti. This is all part of this fourth method of memory, form of memory. Five, those mental images latent in the memory-making faculty, which are the total of the knowledge contacted and the realizations evoked by the right use of mind as the sixth sense. This represents the highest capacity of the lower mind. Acting as a sixth sense on its own plane, the mind perceives phenomena independent of the physical senses, such as mental telepathy, the perception of subtle thought forms, and the deep intellectual synthesis of esoteric facts. However, Patanjali warns that even these high-level realizations still belong to the form world. They're structural modifications of mental matter. Therefore, they remain part of the versatile psychic nature that must ultimately be silenced and dropped. The yogi must eventually surrender even the memory of advanced occult knowledge to achieve the formless liberation of the soul. So, because of that, we'll end the webinar now and I'll cancel all future webinars. No, we're not quite ready for that, but eventually, when one moves to full soul awareness, one must recognize even the highest levels of knowledge for what it is, which are well-constructed thought forms that represent the truth. We call them the truth itself, but because they're still thought forms, they're A reflecting on B. They're, in other words, they are a symbol in written thought of the reality that is the higher truth that it's trying to represent. It eventually even that has to be let go of. Any thoughts or questions so far? I encourage you to anything that you don't quite understand, there's going to be other people that don't as well, so please raise your hand. And if you have ideas, as long as it's based on the material that we're covering, we welcome your ideas. Okay, next, all these forms of the memory faculty have to be dropped and no longer held. They must be recognized as modifications of the mind, of the thinking principle, and therefore as part of that versatile psychic nature, which has to be dominated before the yogi can hope to attain liberation from limitation and from all lower activity. This is the goal. Okay, notice he repeats this idea of versatile psychic nature. You know, it sounds good, really, to be versatile, right? But it manifests as the busyness of mental activity, which is why eventually it has to be let go of. A memory is always a record of the past. However, the soul exists in the eternal now. As long as the mental body is vibrating with the echoes of past physical contacts, past astral desires, or even past spiritual realizations, it is locked into a time-bound frequency. To attain liberation from all activity means shutting down the cyclic playback of the mental body so that the timeless, formless reality of the egoic lotus can finally be registered. This is why DK says, let there be no recollection and yet let memory rule. That requires a little explanation. What's being described here is called by DK that form of recollection. The memory he's talking about are the built-in habits that become unconscious and allow one to function in the three worlds as a disciple. Okay, next up, number six. Yeah, I'm going to read this, even though we didn't read this whole page, because it's the last comment and the last form of memory before we move on to the next sutra. So, six, finally, for it is not necessary to enumerate more intricate subdivisions, memory includes all the accumulated experiences gained by the soul through the many incarnations and stored up in the true consciousness of the soul. So, categories one through five are modifications, right, of the lower mental body, citta, situated within the lower quaternary. They are part of the versatile psychic nature that must be silenced. Whereas category six is causal memory stored in the egoic lotus, and thus is not a modification to be dropped, but is in fact the true consciousness of the soul, or drives this consciousness. Every incarnation leaves an imprint or a distillation of experience on the permanent atoms, physical, astral, permanent atoms in the mental unit. When the soul moves into a new birth, it carries the quality of those experiences as inherent capacity. Okay. Next up, can we get a reader, please?
Yes, Scott, can you read that for us, please?
12. Control of these modifications of the internal organ, the mind, is to be brought about through tireless endeavor and through non-attachment. A few brief explanations are all that is necessary with a sutra as easy to apprehend as this one. Intellectually, its meaning is clear. In practice, however, it is difficult to carry out. One, the internal organ is, of course, the mind. Occidental thinkers should remember that the Eastern occultist does not consider the organs to be the physical organs. The reason for this is that the physical body, in its dense or concrete form, is not regarded as a principle. but simply as the tangible outcome of the activity of the real principles.
Thank you, Scott. Okay, first the sutra itself. 12. The control of these modifications of the internal organ, the mind, is to be brought about through tireless endeavor and through non-attachment. This sutra gives us two occult methods needed to silence the mental body. By defining the mind as an internal organ, Patanjali establishes it as hardware rather than the true self. To master this organ of perception, the yogi must apply one, tireless endeavor, a sustained will-induced tension, which trains the intellect towards the soul, and two, non-attachment, the withdrawal of identification from all lower elemental forms. Together, these dual forces starve the vrittis of their astral fuel while still maintaining the stability needed to receive soul impression. Next, a few brief explanations are all that is necessary with a sutra as easy to apprehend as this one. Intellectually, its meaning is clear. In practice, however, it is difficult to carry out. So I think this is self-evident. We'll move on to number one. The internal organ is, of course, the mind. Occidental thinkers should remember that the Eastern occultist does not consider the organs to be the physical organs. The reason for this is that the physical body in its dense or concrete form is not regarded as a principle, but simply as the tangible outcome of the activity of the real principles. This is a reference to the doctrine of principles, obviously. Science views the physical brain as the generator of thought. The ageless wisdom defines it merely as a receiving terminal. Because the dense physical body possesses no independent will or initiating life, it is not considered a principle. Therefore, the yogi wastes no effort attempting to control the physical brain directly. They apply their discipline entirely to the mental vehicle, knowing that the physical shell must automatically reflect the vibratory state of its inner source. Okay, thoughts or questions? Reader, please.
Okay, Ariane, can you read that for us, please?
The organs, occultly speaking, are such centers of activity as the mind, the various permanent atoms, and the centers of force in the various sheaths. These all have their objective shadows, quote unquote, or results. And these resultant emanations are the external organs, external physical organs. The brain, for instance, is the quote unquote shadow or the external organ of the mind. And it will be found by the investigator that the contents of the brain cavity have a correspondence to the aspects of the human mechanism found upon the mental plane. This latter sentence should be emphasized. It conveys a hint to those capable of taking advantage of it. Two, tireless endeavor means literally constant practice, ceaseless repetition, and the reiterated effort to impose the new rhythm upon the old, and to efface deep-seated habits and modifications by the institution of soul impression.
Thank you, Adrian. Okay, first, the organs, occultly speaking, are such centers of activity as the mind, the various permanent atoms, and the centers of force in the various sheaths, that would be chakras or centers. These all have their objective shadows or results, And these resultant emanations are the external physical organs. So in the occult framework, the true organs are dynamic energy constructs, the mind, the permanent atoms, and the chakras of each of the sheaths. What medical science maps as physical organs, brain, heart, endocrine glands, are the objective shadows of these inner sources. As energy descends through the subtle sheaths, it coagulates into dense matter, precipitating a physical form that mirrors the vibratory blueprint of the inner center, the center on higher levels. Next. The brain, for instance, is the shadow or the external organ of the mind. And it will be found by the investigator that the contents of the brain cavity have a correspondence to the aspects of the human mechanism found upon the mental plane. This latter sentence should be emphasized. It conveys a hint to those capable of taking advantage of it. Okay, the emphasis Bailey refers to is a suggestion that the physical brain mirrors the architecture of its source organ on the mental plane, which projects its shadow into the physical brain cavity. Now, you know, the physical brain itself takes its blueprint from the etheric brain, which is also physical etheric. But the actual source is the quote unquote brain on the mental plane. For this reason, stilling the vrittis and aligning with the soul produces a structurally guaranteed physical correlation in the brain. But this brain illumination is progressive and cumulative, not an instant one-time guarantee triggered by a single achievement of mental control. So the old habits reassert themselves, old thought forms creep back in, and the vrittis come back to life, the habitual vrittis. This is why this, what does he say, strenuous, continuous activity to retrain the mind is necessary. You know, it's in some particular life, one really takes this to be the only way forward, right? Personality loses all of its thraldom, and one absolutely aligns, you know, through karma or lack thereof, one is born into a situation where they come into contact with teachings like these and actually choose in that lifetime to apply them continuously and tirelessly, right? And therefore literally retrain the brain to be to function as the soul has intended the brain to function, which is a reflection of the brain on the mental plane. Okay. Finally, we have tireless endeavor means literally constant practice, ceaseless repetition, and the reiterated effort to impose the new rhythm upon the old and to efface deep-seated habits and modifications by the institution of soul impression. Tireless endeavor, also called abhyasa, is the science of overriding a frequency. You know, there's no morality in this. There's no, oh, you should do this because this is the right thing to do. It's just the science of overriding a frequency, right? The lower mind is heavily conditioned by the lunar rhythm of the personality, literal energetic grooves, which are called samskaras, carved into the mental matter over thousands of incarnations. Because matter naturally resists change, the mind automatically snaps back to these ancient patterns the moment one's discipline relaxes. Therefore, the yogi must use the will to apply ceaseless repetition. Of course, new patterns are applied along the way, so it's not like, you know, you stop doing it for 5 minutes and you go all the way back to the beginning. There are new higher thought forms are impressed over the old, which are of a higher vibration and are easier to then lift to even higher levels. Okay, next up, any thoughts, questions on anything so far? All right, a reader, please.
Okay. Ben, can you read for us, please?
The yogi or master is the result of patient endurance. His achievement is the fruit of a steady effort, which is based upon intelligent appreciation of the work to be done and the goal to be reached, and not upon spasmodic enthusiasm. Non-attachment is the one thing that eventually brings all sense perceptions to perform their legitimate functions. Through non-attachment to those forms of knowledge with which the senses put a man in contact, they continuously lose their hold over him. The time eventually comes when he is liberated and is the master of his senses and of all sense contacts. This does not involve a state wherein they are atrophied and useless, but it is one which in which they are useful to the yogi when and as he chooses, and insofar as he chooses. They are utilized by him in increasing his efficiency in group service and in group endeavor.
Thank you, Ben. Okay, first up, the yogi or master is the result of patient endurance. His achievement is the fruit of a steady effort, which is based upon intelligent appreciation of the work to be done and the goal to be reached, and not upon spasmodic enthusiasm. Okay, so spasmodic enthusiasm is the unstable fuel of emotion, whereas intelligent appreciation and patient endurance are functions of the will, which eventually leads to achievement of the goal. You know, at some point, a vision of the goal begins to take hold, and one is no longer working blindly in resistance to the personality aspect. One is working, but rather is working positively towards this seen and recognized goal. And the weight just shifts. You could say that the hardest thing, you know, I had a spiritual teacher back in the 70s, and I asked him once, what's the hardest thing? And he said, to break the inertia. And, you know, that's always stuck with me. It's like getting started with this and then holding steady, you know, as he says here, steady effort. That initial step is actually the hardest of all, you know, and then to ride along with turning it into a steady effort until one begins to get soul feedback and can feel and have an experience of the plan and of the identity towards which one is moving. Okay, next. Three, Non-attachment is the one thing that eventually brings all sense perceptions to perform their legitimate functions. Interesting. Through non-attachment to those forms of knowledge with which the senses put a man in contact, they continuously lose their hold over him. The time eventually comes when he is liberated and is the master of his senses and of all sense contacts. So, non-attachment, called vairagya, recalibrates the senses. For the average person, the senses translate sensory input into astral reaction, whereas the legitimate function of the senses is simply to report environmental data to the indwelling observer. You know, brings to mind Sherlock Holmes, right? Just that absolute centrally polarized observer. Non-attachment severs the magnetic link between the sensory data and the mind's desire to react, which is, you know, automatic when one is controlled by kama manas. The senses continue to function perfectly in this higher stage, but because the mind no longer identifies with the sensory impact, the forms contacted through the senses lose their magnetic hold. So, you know, I invite you to begin by just determining the difference, you know, as you apply your senses to things, the difference between the experience of the senses, objectively speaking, and your reaction to what those senses are reporting to your central, you know, self, right? Just, you know, whether you have a positive or negative reaction is not the point in this exercise. It's harder when you have a negative reaction to separate the two, but, you know, just note the difference, like you see something and hold that before, you know, you react to what you see. You know, you hear something, hold that hearing just for what it is before the reaction sets in, you know, to what you've heard. It's, you can see how profound this work is. Okay, finally, this does not involve the state wherein they are atrophied, the senses, and useless, but is one in which they are useful to the yogi when and as he chooses, and insofar as he chooses. They are utilized by him in increasing his efficiency in group service and in group endeavor. So the yogi recognizes that the senses are actually a masterpiece of evolutionary engineering, right? And when, I mean, after all, this spent 4.5 root races perfecting this sense and the interpretation of the sense by the mind, you know, for what the sense is reported. And when powered by the will of the soul, can greatly enhance the yogi's ability to serve the group in which they find themselves. In fact, using the senses to operate in the three worlds without attachment hones these senses and stimulates their higher counterparts. Thoughts or questions? You guys are pretty quiet today. Okay, next up. Sutra 13. Could we get a reader, please?
Okay. Before we do that, I do have a question for you. You know, we're talking about the senses here, and we're talking about stopping and trusting and looking at an inner interpretation that is not the outer interpretation. And that always reminds me of the chart with all of the senses the physical senses and the astral senses and the way they morph into those higher senses up through the, what is it, the atmic plane, were they?
Yeah. That's the final.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. Where they become all knowledge, perfection, realization, active service, and beatitude. So right. It really, you know, it takes that hearing and it makes it clairaudience and then higher clairaudience on the mental and then comprehension on the Buddhic. You just know. And then beatitude on the atmic. I mean, that's our roadmap, basically.
Yeah,
is how, and that's what he's talking about here. He's talking about it on the lowest level, but he's talking about bringing it to those higher levels that eventually, not anytime soon for me, we're going to reach. So I appreciate the
Yeah, it's interesting. She wrote this book right after a treatise on cosmic fire, where those senses are described that you're talking about. If you're interested, they're on right around page 188 of treatise on cosmic fire, where he lists all the senses at each level, that which BL was just describing for the sense of sound, right? And it's true that if you know this idea of pondering, you know, if you look at each sense and the way it, DK describes them too, what they're like, you know, what's involved. And if you look at each progression, you get a little more, you could say a little more light is shed on the process of closing the gap between personality and soul and what that looks like, which is described in more general terms here, you know, but actually not so much general terms as just in a different language, right? So yeah, thank you for that, BL.
Yeah, I'm looking for the I'm looking for a chart of that. Let me see if I can.
188 on PCF is the chart.
Yeah, I'm looking to see.
Oh, you mean the one that's separate from the book?
Yeah, that's got all the pretty colors. And let me see if I can paste that into the.
I think.
There we go.
Jeff.
I got it.
Jeff did that
well,
chart.
Jeff did an amazing spreadsheet, but this is a color version of. Yeah. Okay. But
great,
anyway,
great.
I put it in the chat, so.
Okay.
That's something I have it in this big, huge, not this particular version, but a similar one that Victoria Stone did, and it was made into a poster. And I keep it on my desk, and I refer to it all the time because it's just so amazing. But anyway, I'm sorry. Go ahead. You want?
I don't see it yet. You want to? Have you pasted it in? BL?
Yeah.
I'm sorry. I sent it to the wrong place. There we go. I sent it to Zim Zim instead of to everybody, so I'm sorry.
That's all right. So here it is. It's going to be, you can see here, I'll have to scroll it because it's bigger than the little box that I have for this webinar. But the census. Let's see, can I
they're
just,
over on the far right.
Right, they're on the, yeah, good. Far right, but let's see, I'll actually stretch this box out just for the time being. Oh God, it's always harder to do than it should be. You should be able to just grab it and grab, but it moves the whole darn thing. Anyway, but what I can do is drop the whole thing down. There, now you see on the far right, down in the bottom right-hand corner here, you have hearing and the gaseous physical plane. Then you have touch and feeling, sight, feeling, taste, and smell. These are our physical senses and the subplane that they are associated with, which is an interesting study in and of itself. But what we're kind of looking at here is the associated senses. So hearing becomes clairaudience, which is the experience of hearing on astral levels. DK says that you don't hear through ears. You hear with your whole astral body on the astral plane. And it's a quality of the, what's the word I want? Getting a feeling for the astral reality. That's how it experienced. That's all these senses are experienced through getting a feeling for the astral through sound, right? I'm not going to go through them all, but you can do that on your own time through this chart that BL has given you. But when you get up to the higher levels, the highest ones are really the source of the senses, and these senses on it's actually way up here on atmic levels. These are all just ways of describing union with the one, true unity. There is no actual perception of the other at this level. That's why they're called, you know, things like perfection, all knowledge, realization, that state of consciousness that is described as active service and beatitude. These are, you could say, portals into the experience of identification with the one, right? They're so high that it's hard to even connect him directly with the senses, you know, like, for instance, the sense of taste becomes perfection, you know. So, but starting on the Buddha plane, you really do get a sense of the connection with the lower iteration of the senses, right? So, yeah, I could go down this rabbit hole for the rest of the webinar, but I won't. Sorry
for leading you to that rabbit hole. Ariane says, what about the fatigue that comes with the efforts and sleep disrupted by meditation?
What? What about the fatigue that comes with the effort? You mean, how do you get over the fatigue? Or I'm not sure what your question really is here. Oh gosh, what am I doing?
Yeah. Please unmute yourself. Yeah.
Just thanks. How to work with that without being slowed down by that. Yeah.
How to deal with fatigue just in general?
Yeah, from overstriving or striving in ways that, you know, where you're sort of trying to serve more, you know, do these things that take a certain amount of energy.
Yeah. Fatigue comes through resistance. Not necessarily through endeavor, right? So the fatigue comes as a result of, you know, the personality resistance to what you're endeavoring. That's why purification is essential as a prerequisite for this work, you know, and so you continuously are engaged in right thought, right action, and right speech. And you combine that with service, study, meditation. That's the formula for getting beyond it. Just let me finish. For getting beyond fatigue, you're not going to just take the fatigue and directly, be able to get rid of it. You have to go through these other steps in order to defeat that reaction, which is fatigue. Yes, go ahead.
I was going to say, in right proportion, One of the obstacles is incontinence. I mean, you have to have the right proportion in everything you do, whether it's specifically the sexual urge or it's giving up your energy, too much of your energy to other things. You have to have that right proportion in the mix of everything that you do.
Yeah, you can't do everything all at once all the time, in spite despite what the movie says, right? You have to you can only do what you can do. So you work and meanwhile you practice harmlessness, and as I said, purification, right action, right thought, right speech. You keep those continuously going. Yeah, it's a big question, what you're acting because acting asking because the personality will use fatigue as a method to stop you from pursuing your goal, yeah, it's just part of its mechanism, because it recognizes its own defeat and will put obstacles in the way, and that's certainly one of them. Okay, let's see here.
You needed a reader, didn't you?
Yeah, we need a reader.
Okay, let me see who's next up on our. Barbara, can you read for us, please?
Yes, 13. Tireless endeavor is a constant effort to restrain the modification of the mind. This is one of the most difficult sutras to translate, so as to give its real significance. The idea involved is that of the constant effort made by the spiritual man to restrain the modification or the fluctuation of the mind, and to control the lower psychic versatile nature. In order fully to express his own spiritual nature. Thus and only thus can the spiritual man live the life of the soul each day upon the physical plane. Charles Johnson, in his translation, seeks to give this meaning in the words, "The right use of the will is the steady effort to stand in spiritual being." The idea involved is that of applying to the mind, regarded as a sixth sense, the same restraint that the five lower senses are subjected to. Their outward going activities are stopped and they are held from responding to the pull or attraction of their particular field of knowledge.
Thank you, Barbara. Okay, first, the sutra itself. 13. Tireless endeavor is the constant effort to restrain the modifications of the mind. Okay, so restraint in Sanskrit, nirodha, is not repression. And going to Ariane's point, that often is what leads to fatigue. You don't, in other words, you don't repress. It only repression only furthers the energy of the vrittis, which are the modifications of the mind. Instead, restraint is the use of the will to hold the mental substance in a steady state of tension. Dikei's definition of tension is like a one-pointed focus, right? Thereby subduing the vrittis. Right, so you're not chasing the vrittis around trying to stop this one and stop that one. And it's like that thing of don't think about elephants, right? It's you approach it positively through holding one's mental substance in this one-pointed point of tension. And this automatically then restrains the vrittis. Okay. Next. This is one of the most difficult sutras to translate so as to give its real significance. The idea involved is that of the constant effort made by the spiritual man to restrain the modifications or the fluctuations of the mind and to control the lower psychic versatile nature in order fully to express his own spiritual nature. The difficulty in translating Patanjali lies in the limitations of Western language, which often reduces restraint and effort to psychological suppression. The true occult significance is structural. The constant effort does not originate from the personality fighting itself. It is the downward pressure of the will applied by the soul to lock the lower psychic nature into a state of immobile tension. The versatile psychic nature is dominated and held still for one reason: to act as an unobstructed window for the expression of the soul's true nature. Stillness of the lower mind is a prerequisite for the externalization of the higher. But the focus, as I said before, is not psychological repression, but the this idea of using the will and imagining, visualizing it as a downward pressure of the will applied by the soul, which through its own, that potency, locks the lower psychic nature into a state of immobile tension. That's very different than trying to work directly with the personality, which I think is akin to cutting off the heads of the Hydra in the labors of Hercules, that the eighth labor in Scorpio, right, where Hercules approaches the Hydra and just starts, you know, lopping off the heads, and three grow in the place of each head, because you're trying to deal with the personality at the personality level, where, you know, the way that Hercules deals with this is he lifts the Hydra into the air, right, which is akin to invoking the downward pressure of the will applied by the soul in order to lock out the lower psychic nature. That would be the equivalent of lifting the Hydra into the air. Both, you know, the air is the Buddhic plane where all the activities of the Hydra have no source, and so they naturally die out.
Francis?
Yeah.
Sorry. Ben says the monastic practice don't repress, transmute.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. It's the same idea. Repression is always at the level of trying to use tools that exist on the same level as that which you're trying to repress, right? It's just not effective. It doesn't work, right? You might be able to do it for a bit, but then it just resurfaces, usually with much more vigor. Transmuting requires calling in the higher powers in order to gain that transmutation. In this case, using the power of the will as a, in order to hold, to dominate the versatile psychic nature. Okay, thanks, Ben. Next, thus and only thus can the spiritual man live the life of the soul each day upon the physical plane. Okay. Charles Johnson, in his translation, seeks to give this meaning in the words, quote, "The right use of the will is a steady effort to stand in spiritual being." So here's Charles Johnston and his book, The Yoga Sutras of Patanjali, which Alice Bailey read along with a number of other books on the subject. To stand in spiritual being means to polarize one's consciousness in the soul and compel one's lower vehicle to align with the will of the soul. And that just describes the end goal, of course. These sutras are given in order to describe the methods by which this can be accomplished, right? That's the great value of this book, is that we are given particular ways in which to accomplish this. Okay, any thoughts, more thoughts or questions? Next. The idea involved is that of applying to the mind, regarded as the sixth sense, which is the synthetic sense, the same restraint that the five lower senses are subjected to. Their outward going activities are stopped, and they are held from responding to the pull or traction of their particular field of knowledge, right? There's a lot in that paragraph, actually. So meditation, service, and study are the three methods given by DK for walking the path. But at some point, the disciple has to learn to control the mind used during study by withdrawing its outgoing attention from the periphery of outer activity and concentrate it at the center point of soul being. Okay. Okay, next up, reader, please.
Nikki, I don't hear you yet. Can you read that for us, please?
Miguel, your request to her wasn't heard. You must have been muted when you asked her.
Oh, Vicky, can you read for us, please? You should be able to unmute yourself. Okay, I don't see her doing it. Tom, can you read for us, please?
That when the object to be gained is sufficiently valued and the efforts work all towards its attainment are persistently followed without intermission, then the steadiness of the mind, restraint of the vrittis, is secured. As followers of Raja Yoga must first be All followers of Raja Yoga must first be devotees. All intense love of the soul and of all that knowledge of the soul entails will carry the aspirant with sufficient steadiness toward his goal. The objective in view, union with the soul and consequently with the oversoul and with all souls, must be justly appraised. The reasons for its achievement correctly judged, and the results to be gained most earnestly desired or loved before the aspirant will make that sufficiently strong effort which will give him his hold upon the modifications of the mind and consequently upon his entire lower nature. When this appreciation is true enough and his ability to go forward with the work of subjugation and control is without intermission, then the time will come when the student will know consciously and increasingly what is the meaning of restraint of the modifications.
Thanks, Tom. Sorry. First, the sutra itself. When the object to be gained is sufficiently valued, and the efforts towards its attainment are persistently followed without intermission, then the steadiness of the mind, restraint of the vrittis, is secured. Okay, without intermission means maintaining a continuous background frequency of soul tension until the old personality structures atrophy, and the mind restructures itself into a form more capable of consistent soul contact. You know, again, this is comes at a particular incarnation where one has prepared for many, many lifetimes, and then it occurs to the indweller that there is no other pursuit that is worthwhile, right? And then we have this, quote unquote, the object is sufficiently valued, right? It becomes the only game in town. And, you know, for most of us, certainly for me, this is not yet true. You know, it's like somebody, a disciple once put it, you know, it's as though your life and your physical plane life, personality life, occurs to you as though you're drowning, and you do everything you can in order to get your head above water and breathe, you know, the pure air of the soul. It's that as long as personality life has appeal, and again, no morality here, that's we are just at that stage of becoming where we're still gaining experience, gathering experience, you know, leading to a time when the object to be gained is sufficiently valued, you know, it's so understated, right? Okay. So next up, all followers of Raja Yoga must first be devotees. Only intense love of the soul and of all that knowledge of the soul entails will carry the aspirant with sufficient steadiness towards his goal. So Raja Yoga is the science of the mind, but the intellect alone lacks the motive power to break the gravitational pull of the personality. Therefore, the work of the mind must be fueled by the fire of devotion, for it is this magnetic force of the second aspect that allows the soul to become, quote unquote, sufficiently valued, right? We're in a Buddhic astral solar system. And so the victory gained over the astral body through lifting all aspects of the astral into this quality called aspiration is an essential element. You know, even in building the Antikarana, DK talks about how, you know, you create this great pool of energy on through focusing in the mental unit, but then you drop down into the astral and you project a stream through visualization to the Buddhic, onto the Buddhic plane. So a very important aspect of this. It can't be done purely mentally. Okay, next up, the objective in view, union with the soul, and consequently with the oversoul and with all souls, must be justly appraised. The reason for its achievement correctly judged, and the result to be gained most earnestly desired. See, here we are again, desired or loved. You know, the second initiation, desire turns into love. Before the aspirant will make that sufficiently strong effort, which will give him his hold upon the modifications of the mind and consequently upon his entire lower nature. So first The goal must be justly appraised. The yogi must consider the energetic realities of the path, right? Second, this mental blueprint must be brought to life by the magnetic fire of quote unquote earnest desire or the love aspect. Only then, in combination, can the disciples will be truly engaged and the quote unquote sufficiently strong effort needed to still the mental modifications be applied, right? One can learn the science fairly, I mean, it's you know, it's an awesome piece of knowledge, but relative to the will and the continuity necessary to apply the science, just learning the science is relatively easy, right? It's this alignment of the justly appraised aspect of the mental and the and then bringing in that magnetic fire of earnest desire, bringing those to bear is where the real work begins. And finally, when this appreciation is true enough and his ability to go forward with the work of subjugation and control is without intermission, then the time will come when the student will know consciously and increasingly what is the meaning of restraint of the modifications. So when the forces of the intellect, love, and the will reach a critical mass and the tension is held, quote unquote, without intermission, the yogi's effort results in a deepening of their process and they begin to feel the chaotic modifications of the mental body calmed into a receptive stillness. Of course, you know, this is incremental. It says, you know, she says here, to go forward with the work of subjugation and control is without intermission. Yes, that eventually has to be arrived at, but it's not going to be like, you know, you take this webinar and then you go, okay, that's it. I'm going to do that, right? And yeah, maybe you're inspired, you know, through aspiration to make a stronger effort, and it moves you towards a time that you can do this without intermission, right? But it's progressive, and as a result of the progress made, literally lifetime from lifetime to the next, that effort is stored in the mental permanent atoms, you know, in terms of the gains made in the quality of the matter of the three bodies, right? So when you, there's continuity through that quality of the substance in the three bodies until you finally reach a life where you have a predominant amount of atomic substance in your bodies, and then you have this motivation to work without intermission. You're then ready to do that. Okay. Any thoughts or questions on Sutra 14? This is the shortest of the commentaries on the sutra, interestingly. Okay, next up, can we get a reader, please?
Yes. Kirsten, can you read that for us, please?
Non-attachment is freedom from longing for all objects of desire, either earthly or traditional, either here or hereafter. Non-attachment can also be described as thirstlessness. This is the most correct occult term to use, as it involves the dual idea of water. the simple or material existence and desire, the quality of the astral plane, whose symbol is also water. The idea of man being the fish is curiously complete here. This symbol, as is the case with all symbols, has seven meanings. Two are of use in this place. One, the fish is the symbol of the Vishnu aspect, the Christ principle, the second aspect of divinity, the Christ in incarnation, whether it is the cosmic Christ expressing himself through a solar system or the individual Christ, the potential savior without each human being, within each human being. This is the Christ in you, the hope of glory. If the student will also study the fish avatar of Vishnu, he will learn still more.
Thank you, Kirsten. Okay, first, the sutra itself. 15, non-attachment is freedom from longing for all objects of desire, either earthly or traditional, either here or hereafter. So longing is a kind of an active magnetic tether, the projection of desire force towards some form or another. True non-attachment, as I said before, it's called vairagya, demands the cessation of all magnetic longing. The disciple must sever their attachment, not only to the physical world, but even to their own spiritual ambition. Of course, again, I say this is progressive. You know, you don't start by with your own spiritual ambition. You start, first of all, by just recognize this as a desirable concept, you know, that this is one of the main methods of liberation. And then you begin the long, long process of severing these magnetic tethers, first of all, to the more dense, obvious physical realities. And again, you do this through changes in your thought, speech, and actions, right? First of all, you're acting as if, you know, you still feel the desires, but through thought, speech, and actions, you use the discipline to control those aspects, to reflect the idea of severing these magnetic tethers. Eventually, and this is experience I've had, it works, you know, through restraint in thought, speech, and action, you find that those realities actually, of non-attachment, that these non-attachments actually come about, right? So that's the beginning of the path, right? Much, much, much later in the game, you know, third initiation kind of stuff. The tethers to your own spiritual ambition, for example, comes in. And, you know, what she's talking about here is spiritual ambition instead of adherence to the plan. You know, in other words, wow, I really want to be a third initiate. What do I have to do to be a third initiate? Instead of what can I do to serve the plan? You know, so it's a high form of severing, you could say. Okay, next, her commentary. Non-attachment can also be described as thirstlessness. This is the most correct occult term to use, as it involves the dual idea of water, the symbol of material existence, and desire, the quality of the astral plane, whose symbol is also water. So the astral plane is synonymous with water. It is fluid, stormy, and distorts the light of the soul through glamour. Of course, it's just a metaphor. in terms of like our physical plane water, but it does, its actual substance is watery in nature. To thirst, called in Sanskrit trishna, is to magnetically crave this water, demanding constant emotional stimulation. I mean, there are people who their whole life is governed by this craving for emotional stimulation. That's the kama manasic state of being. Therefore, thirstlessness is a perfectly appropriate descriptor for astral non-attachment. The yogi uses the fire of the mental plane to sort of evaporate or make thirstless the pull of the lower astral nature. Again, this is progressive. You first of all raise that thirst on the astral plane to higher and higher substances within the astral realm, you know, until you're focused completely and that astral quality called aspiration, right, which is the last to go. Next, the idea of man being the fish is curiously complete here. This symbol, as is the case with all symbols, has seven meanings. Two are of use in this place. So, having defined the astral world as water, Bailey introduces the symbol of the fish and our relation to it. And she's going to unfold this over the next seven points. And so we'll just continue here. First, the fish is the symbol of the Vishnu aspect, the Christ principle, the second aspect of divinity, the Christ in incarnation. Whether it is the cosmic Christ expressing himself through a solar system, or the individual Christ, the potential savior within each human being. Okay, the Christ principle or Vishnu aspect works through the second ray of love wisdom, the cohesive magnetic energy that binds spirit to matter. The symbol of the fish represents this divine consciousness voluntarily submerging itself into the watery environment of material incarnation in order to redeem it. This is the one of the reasons that Pisces is associated with sacrifice and has for its esoteric ruler first ray Pluto, you know, this idea of sacrifice by willful or voluntary submergence into the waters of matter, the lower quaternary, right? The human soul or Christ principle makes the same sacrifice at a microcosmic level by submerging itself in the waters of the personality. And finally, this is the Christ in you, the hope of glory. I'm looking for the name of this. What does COL stand for? What is it? Somebody know? No, I don't know.
Colossians.
What is it?
Colossians.
Okay. 127. If the student will also study the fish avatar of Vishnu, he will learn still more. Okay, here Bailey bridges Christian mysticism and Hindu cosmology to reveal a single science of the soul. The word glory, in Paul's phrase, the hope of glory, is the esoteric term for the radiation of the causal body. The Christ in you is the second ray principle embedded in the human mechanism, guaranteeing the eventual transfiguration of, you know, the physical etheric form. To understand how this operates over time, Bailey points to the Matsya avatar, the Hindu myth of Vishnu incarnating as a fish to save the seeds of humanity from a cosmic flood. microcosmically, this is the function of the human soul, for it is this divine fish that preserves our spiritual identity across hundreds of incarnations until the consciousness can finally rise above the astral waters. The Egyptian Neith serves a similar function. Okay. Next up, can we get a reader, please? Actually, you know what? I think we'll stop here because this is a whole new section that's going to take a lot of commentary. So I think we'll pull the plug here. Let me look at the chats.
I think we've covered all of the chats.
Okay.
Let me go with the next webinar up is Treatise on Cosmic Fire on Friday, 11 September.
5 days, that's this coming Friday.
Yep. And then Secret Doctrine on the 20th of September. And then the next Light of the Soul will be for October. And all of those are at 7 p.m. GMT.
Right. All my webinars are at 7 p.m. GMT. So
until we change time.
Right.
In November.
Right. But I hold the local time. It changes, you know, it's fall back, right? We go an hour back, but I keep the same local time. But in GMT time, that time changes. Goes to 8, right?
Yes, and it the Europeans change at a different time than we do, so
Right. We have
there's
to deal
a
with that.
little, yeah,
Oh.
there's a little adjustment at that time, but
That's in the future. That's
yeah, and hopefully by now everybody knows their time zone
yeah right
and what to do with it.
Any final thoughts? We have a couple of minutes if you want to you know, if you want to bring anything up that's it's something I'd really like to emphasize, because AAB doesn't do it so much, is the, you know, she just states outright, you know, this is what's required. You have to put yourself in this stage of being, you know, in order to affect this change. And, you know, ultimately that's true, but you have to consider, you know, because it seems impossible, you know, like to always, you know, hold yourself in that high state of, you know, rejecting all the vrittis. You know, as Ariane said, it's exhausting, it's impossible, right? So we do what we can and we make the effort until we are born in that lifetime where it occurs to us that that is the only way forward. Yes, Ariane.
Yeah, I really appreciated this class because you brought in like the psychological and the practical and also our vulnerability in relationship to these high ideals. I personally have listened to the CD of this book for years now in my car, and I feel like I've hit a wall.
That's great.
I've hit a wall because I can't, there's something that I can't get, you know, I can't translate it into my personal life in some important way. Something is missing. So I really appreciated this class because it seemed to address that in-between space,
right,
where, you know, there's an interval between what we aspire to and what we are. And we have to address that interval. We can't just say, well, one day. I mean, that's reassuring, but also how to deal with the interval.
Right, exactly. There are steps that could be taken now that don't include, let's see, what did she say here in this? I think it was the previous one that was so adamant, you know. The efforts toward its attainment are persistently followed without intermission. You know, it's just then the steadiness of the mind, restraint of the vrittis is secured. So, you know, the thought form behind this is that this is what's needed to finally starve out these vrittis, these modifications of the mind, right? But on the way to this, you practice this discipline, so that and you fall out of it, and then you practice it again, and until a time comes when you can do it without intermission, you know. And as I said before, in doing so, you build up higher and higher quality of substance in your forms, which makes it much easier to approach this work in future lifetimes, you know. I mean, we'd all like to just do it now, right? But it's a very challenging process to engage in continuously. Okay.
Francis,
yeah.
I posted a link in the chat. I just wanted to say that when he was setting up all the meditations for Quest Universal, Michael created a number of meditations from Light of the Soul.
Oh, and yes, right.
If you haven't seen them yet, students in Great Quest and students in Quest Universal, they go through them. And some of them, that means they're doing them 2 years in a row because they're really important. So that's what that link is. So you can, you know, it's also on our public website. There's some slides, there's some audio recordings, there's some video recordings of the combination of the slides and them. And I highly recommend them because, as Ariane said, you can listen to the
tape, yeah,
to the tapes, but Michael's meditations always went along with the study. You know, it was service, right. It was study, and it was meditation, because you have to let the soul listen to it and the soul guide you through that. And that's what, you know, with proper alignment in the meditation, that's going to help you do that. This is just such a, sutras from Patanjali are so beautiful.
Yeah, they really are a lifesaver. They are how, at some point, we're going to pull ourselves out of the personality condition, you know. So it's just at, you know, where are you in your interface to this information? Obviously, since you're here, you know, you are at some stage of this interface, right? This will continuously progress. Okay, yeah, that's all I have to say on that.
Well, does anyone know what the correct pronunciation is of Patanjali? Or
that's it.
Is that it?
That's it. Patanjali, I've heard, you know, Patanjali, but no, I've Patanjali, I think, is a more correct pronunciation.
Yes, that's the way I've always heard it. So,
yeah,
right, wrong, or indifferent, I like it.
yeah. Ultimately, you'd have to ask, you know, an Indian person, but even they might have it, you know, a variation in how it's pronounced. Okay, that's it for today. Much love to you
thank
all.
Thank you, everyone.
Thanks for attending. Appreciate it. Be well.
And we'll see you all next time.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Bye-bye.